This is Virginia Insights. I'm Tom Graham. When was the last time you watched a TV crime drama? Remember any forensics in the storyline? Investigators who probe everything from fingerprints to voice patterns to DNA residue permeate all manner of popular shows today. But as far as I can tell, no hit TV mystery has yet made a star of the forensic psychiatrist. When Hollywood finally gets around to it, they ought to talk to today's guest. Over the past 20 years, his investigations have been instrumental in everything from murder cases to child custody disputes. He's agreed to pull back the veil on just what a forensic psychiatrist does, but since he's also written a popular textbook covering all of psychiatry, just about any brain-related topic will be fair game when we begin our conversation with Dr. Bruce Cohen, right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. We begin today's broadcast with a look at forensic psychiatry, in part because there's a good chance you've never met a forensic psychiatrist before, and one of Virginia's leaders in the field agreed to make some time for us. But after we contacted him, we also discovered that he has written what may be the only single-author medical school textbook on all of psychiatry, something some of his colleagues have called incredible and brilliant. So whether you have questions about how psychiatry and the justice system intersect, or questions about how any other aspect of psychiatry works, you are invited to join our conversation at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Bruce Cohen is consulting psychiatrist to the Albemarle-Charlottesville Regional Jail, director of forensic psychiatry training at the University of Virginia, as well as faculty in UVA's Institute for Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy. His book is titled Theory and Practice of Psychiatry. Dr. Cohen, welcome to the Insight Studios.
Hi, Tom. Thrilled to be here.
Well, so I have to ask, Bruce, do people get nervous when they first meet you because they figure any bad thoughts they have, you're going to know about it?
You know, I worried about that. Is this really the field I want to go into? You go to a cocktail party and people either say to you, well, which one is that, psychiatry or psychology? Who's the one who writes for the medicines? Or that they're going to ask, you're probably analyzing me right now. And then I realized I just don't go to cocktail parties. Since Mad Men, I don't think they have cocktail parties anymore. And so that made it a lot easier to go into the field. I think in general, People don't ask that much about it. And what I loved about psychiatry when I was in medical school is right now we don't have a lot of lab tests. We've got a few, but so much of what we do involves talking to the patient and getting the story, getting the narrative, and trying to figure out what's going on with a person. And we do that in all of medicine. I think it's still just much more at the forefront in psychiatry. So in the end, I didn't worry as much about whether people got self-conscious around me.
Forensic psychiatry. What is it?
That's psychiatry as it interfaces with the legal system. And so there's two main ways it could interface. You could have psychiatry consulting to the courts, whether it's in the criminal realm, like an insanity evaluation or competence to stand trial, or even a capital murder sentencing evaluation. Or it could be in the civil realm, like personal injury cases. A person, say, in a car accident who is maybe saying that they had a head injury and post-traumatic stress disorder, or assessing someone's competence to make a will. Or it could be the legal system as applied to medical psychiatric practice. And when you think about it, we don't see this as much in the medical arena, but we see it some, but especially with psychiatric illness, we have a whole set of laws involving things like civil commitment into the hospital. Some people have to go into the hospital involuntarily. Issues of when can you treat a person against their will and when can't you. Issues of assessing when can you violate confidentiality when a person is making threats against other people. And so that really is a whole area that involves clinical medical practice where the legal system comes in and tries to resolve competing interests, basically.
You give an example in your textbook of somebody who I think many of us have heard, Bruce, about situations where a psychiatrist is asked to determine if somebody has to be committed to a mental treatment institution of some kind against their will. But you even talk about somebody being so depressed because they have cancer that a psychiatrist may be able or may at least be asked to determine if this person can be forced to take cancer treatment that they are denying because they are so depressed that they can't even think about the possibility of the treatment working.
Yeah, that would really be true in all of medical treatment, right? It's not the case that we would equate any single diagnosis with having no personhood and not being able to make decisions for yourself, not being able to make authentic decisions. What we'd really be looking to see in that particular case is that there is a mental condition, that mental condition is causing symptoms like disorganized thinking or psychotic symptoms like delusions about the treatment or that you deserve to burn in hell because of all the horrible things you've done in your life, and that those symptoms specifically impair the person in making that specific decision that we're asking them to make. And again, we want to make sure that that's not us projecting our own wishes and desires that they get treatment, but really potentially even interview family, friends, to get a sense of whether this person is not the person that they normally are, absent some other supervening psychiatric condition.
Well, you mentioned delusions, and to the small degree that any of us outside of your field are familiar with how psychiatry and the courts sometimes intersect, it probably is from those TV crime shows I mentioned at the beginning, where forensics become so much a part of the show, but most of us don't think of psychiatry as being part of forensics. And yet, when it comes to people having delusions, you have some experience in the criminal justice system that's just as remarkable as some of the things that we see in those made-up TV shows.
Yeah, I mean, in general, you won't see a forensic psychologist or a forensic psychiatrist working with the cops to catch the criminals. Really, it's a much more limited role. And I should also mention that when a psychiatrist, a psychologist, or social worker goes into court, we are not going there to make decisions in lieu of the legal system. We're really just there to help advise the court so that they can make a more accurate determination. Because otherwise, they need to make those decisions in any case. We're just trying to make sure that if there are specific symptoms that might not be brought out by the judge or prosecutor talking to the defendant, that we've had a chance to explore those things more.
But wasn't there a case where a young man thought his mother was taken over by aliens or a robot or something?
Yeah, I mean that's an example, sure.
And another case where a mother thought her son was taken over by demons?
Right. Now these are cases where if you were to just look at the person killed her son, or the 20-year-old killed his mother, in the absence of a more detailed interview, it would be very tempting to say this person is fully accountable and responsible for their actions. You do the crime, you do the time. And I think in both of those cases, it became pretty clear to the defendant's attorney that this is an impaired person that they're dealing with. But they don't know exactly what the nature of that impairment is. And so when you do a forensic evaluation, it involves not only interviewing that person, but trying to get any old hospital records, talking to as many collateral informants as you can get, even reviewing things like the autopsy report to see if the behaviors that they're describing really do fit together.
So to you who are listening, we are going to be skipping around a lot this hour. So if you hear a topic that you'd like to address, but by the time your call gets through, we've gone on to another subject, no problem. Going backward and forward is perfectly permissible today at 888-WMRA-TALK. But on the subject of forensic psychiatry, I am curious, do you have a sense that people too often get away with things because they claim to have a mental illness? Or are you of the persuasion that we put too many people in jail instead of getting them mental health treatment? In all numbers, 888-967-2825 is how to reach us by phone. On Facebook, you can find us listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. So tell us more about the mother who killed her son because she thought he was possessed by demons.
Well, here's an example of a of what if you simply read a few paragraphs about it in the paper, you really probably would be most likely to project either the thought, like in the Andrea Yates case, for example. It's amazing how there were people who either felt this is a clear-cut case of insanity because what mother would kill her child? She must be ill.
This is a bit more than 10 years ago in Houston. Andrea Yates, the woman who drowned, was it five children?
That's right. And you could see a person saying, I've been mad at my kids. I at times have had the urge to hit them. I have no sympathy for this person. If she did the crime, she should be punished for it. So in the end, when you hear about the story without any of the full-blown details, one does have their own prejudices that they're more likely to project on it, especially when you get to a charged topic like a mother who kills her child. In this particular case, it was a woman who had a history of mental illness.
Was this in Virginia?
This was in Virginia, up in Northern Virginia in the D.C. area.
Now, unlike many consultations, I imagine that if this ends up in the court as a matter of public record, you're allowed to give away some detail that otherwise would have to be confidential.
That's correct. That's correct.
So this is can you tell us the woman's name?
Well, it was so many years ago.
Okay. But it was in Northern Virginia?
Yes.
And how old a woman was this person?
This was a woman in her 30s who had a known history of mental illness. She was in treatment for it. She would get into periods of either paranoid delusions or periods of depression, where the delusions tended to go along with her depressed mood, feelings of extreme guilt, blameworthiness, and feeling that she had sinned. But in this particular case, over a period of weeks, very subtly, she had started getting messages through the computer monitors at work. She started noticing things around her apartment, things like the dog staring at her a certain way and seeing that something was trying to communicate with her through the dog, and ultimately culminating in her having those same kind of experiences with her son, that when she looked at the son, she knew for a fact that this son was possessed by demons and that the only way to save her son's soul was to kill him.
And how old was the son?
The son was about 6 years old. This is obviously not the typical case that you would see in a courtroom setting where a person says, I was overwhelmed with anger or I was overwhelmed with jealousy. We all have had experience of feelings that our emotions overwhelm us and saying, well, I'm not fully responsible. It was my emotions that were responsible. In general, in the courts, what they'll say to that is, just because it was harder for you to control yourself because you were upset, that does not mean you did not have the capacity for self-control. You can see in a case like this, though, where if a person is so ill that their perception of reality itself is distorted and that they're acting on their delusions, the question becomes, to what extent do we still hold that person personally, morally worthy of blame? And that's sort of the key issue. It's not something that psychiatrists struggle with. It's something that we as a society have to struggle with as to what extent we hold people accountable for their actions when some other medical problem is playing a significant role in putting a big thumb on the scale in one direction.
What happened in this case?
In this case, she was found insane. And so that's really the exception when you think about it.
And were you part of the evaluation of?
Yes, I was originally retained by the public defender's office to assess her in this case.
What kind of public reaction was there? Again, you say this is many years ago, to a woman being found, I take it, not guilty by version of insanity after killing her 6-year-old son.
Well, in most of these cases, I'd say a part of it depends, I think, on how heavily publicized the case is in the newspapers and sort of how morally offended the community is at the outset, even before the case goes to trial. But in this case, I think that once the details came out, it wasn't something, I guess, that made a lot of headlines around the country, for example. I think there's cases like this every day.
Is she still in treatment today? Do you know?
I actually don't know what the further details of that case are. There are other cases that I am aware of, but in that particular case, I sort of played my part and was gone.
Well, we'll ask you some about that, but also because you've got this fascinating textbook on all of psychiatry, we're going to move even to a wider discussion of mental health when we get back. Bruce Cohen says early on in life, becoming a doctor was not something he thought was in his future, even though his dad was an OBGYN. As an undergraduate, Bruce majored in creative writing. But eventually, he would go on to medical school at Johns Hopkins, choosing psychiatry in part, he says, because of the call of people's stories. Dr. Cohen hears a lot of stories today. He serves as consulting psychiatrist to the Albemarle Charlottesville Regional Jail. He heads up the Forensic Psychiatry Residency Program at the University of Virginia and has worked for many years himself as a forensic psychiatrist. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. As I mentioned to the audience a little earlier, if anybody wants to go back and ask you questions that relate to forensic psychiatry, we certainly can at 888-WMRA-TALK. But I have this huge, was it like 570-page textbook in my hand called The Theory and Practice of Psychiatry that you wrote all on your own.
Yes, even the index. I remember the index very well.
I've never seen a medical school textbook. Not that I've read a lot of them, but I've certainly never even seen the cover of one on a whole field of medical specialty that was written by one person. Is this some sign of mental health on your part?
Probably obsessionality, right? Or maybe narcissism.
and I got to tell you, Dr. Cohen, it's a little tough going in some places with some of the medical terminology, but it was much more reader-friendly for somebody like myself who knows very little medical technology. It was much more reader-friendly than I thought it was going to be. And some of the general issues that you get into in the first few chapters speak to things that I think everybody wonders about if the subject of mental health or mental illness or psychiatry comes up. The whole issue of to what extent is mental illness really a disease? And why do some people completely reject the idea that it is? So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, one thing that makes psychiatry more complicated is that, when you even look to say, what is it a psychiatrist does? It raises question marks in people's head. And they don't have those questions when we think about, say, cardiology. The cardiologist studies the heart and the vascular system. We can say the same thing about urology or neurology. But when we get to psychiatry, what you're studying is mental life. You're studying thoughts and feelings and behaviors rather than skin and bone and viscera. And out of that study of mental life comes these questions about, can you study thoughts? Can you study feelings in a rigorous or scientific way? So that's the first hurdle. If we're going to label people on the basis of their experiences, can two people interview the same patient and reach the same diagnosis? And even if they can reach the same diagnosis, it raises the question of what lies behind that diagnosis. Not everything that we treat in psychiatry is a disease. So, for example, if I go into the emergency room and I see a person who's suicidal because his girlfriend broke up with him, I would not kick him out of the emergency room and say, you don't have a disease, so I'm not going to treat you. We see people in distress for other reasons. And so I think everyone would agree that some of the things we treat are diseases. The most obvious ones are things like acute gross delirium, say due to kidney failure or liver failure, or dementia, for example, due to Alzheimer's disease or due to strokes. I think we could all agree that just like a car that's got a broken engine, that there's something broken in a person who's got a disease like that. Then we get to areas like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, where we know that they have features of diseases. There's genetic elements. They run in families. There's certain medication interventions that seem to work better than placebo pills. But we also know that some of those symptoms overlap with feelings that all of us can have.
So give me some examples.
Well, who hasn't been in a really good mood, or who hasn't at times felt really despairing, or who hasn't had such acute anxiety that it maybe even borders on a full-blown anxiety attack? And so, once we get to those kind of conditions, it raises questions about where we want to draw the lines between what we consider ordinary human experience and what we want to label as being a psychiatric disorder. And again, just because we label it a disorder doesn't mean it's a disease. I think we can all agree that there's people who start out dieting and the diet becomes so severe that now we would say it's outside of the person's control and we say they have anorexia nervosa. Or a person starts drinking in college like their buddies and eventually the behavior becomes so ingrained and inflexible that we consider it the addiction of alcoholism. And then at a certain point, when a person is so starved with anorexia or so impaired in their brain functioning due to the long-term effects of alcohol, I think we could agree that at the more end stage, we've got biological changes that we could call it a disease. But earlier on, what we were talking about is behavior patterns that became outside a person's control. And so we get into these societal debates about whether this is a disease or not. Psychiatry tries to be agnostic by calling these things disorders, which simply means it's something that's impairing a person and that's deserving of treatment. But how we label people obviously has significant implications, because if you take a person and say that they have Asperger's disease or that they have bipolar disorder, that could help explain a lot about the problems that they've been getting into in their life until now. And it also maybe tells them there's treatments that could help you get better. On the other hand, there could be a group of people who say, oh, I'm not responsible for anything I do. That was my Asperger's or that was my bipolar disorder. And so you can see that the act of labeling people is not a benign thing. And it's something that doctors in general, I think, need to be circumspect about doing and understand our terminology, not just in psychiatry, but in all of medicine.
So to you on the other side of your radio, do you know someone who's suffered a mental illness? Have you yourself ever struggled with mental health problems? How satisfied were you with the kind of treatment that was available? Our phone number, 888-967-2825, is easy to remember as 888-WMRA-TALK. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Okay, Dr. Bruce Cohen, author of The Theory and Practice of Psychiatry, how many people in America, what percentage of the population experience mental illness in their lifetime?
I mean, it depends on what you define as mental illness. If we were to look at very mild conditions, like low-grade depression or excessive worry that at times, especially during periods of conflict in a person's life or major decisions, causes them suffering or distress, or if we include things like cigarette nicotine dependence, you start getting to very high numbers. More than half of Americans, using those criteria, would have some sort of mental disorder. If we talk about much more severe and incapacitating disorders, then maybe we're talking about, say, half of that number. But even so,
that's 25%.
That's right. We're really talking about a significant group of people. If we include everyone who's ever been diagnosed with a major depressive disorder, which could be 10 to 20% of people, if we include bipolar disorder, which in its more severe form is about 1% of people, but in less severe forms could be as many as 5, 6, 7% of people, we start talking real numbers here.
How can somebody tell if they're clinically depressed?
The key question would be whether the depression starts becoming more autonomous of life events. We all have moods, and generally speaking, our moods are proportional to what's going on in our life. So when we talk about clinical depression, we're talking about that the person is now depressed even when circumstances in their life don't seem to be playing as much of a role in that. Also, a person can get certain physical symptoms with their depression, such as pervasive problems with their sleep or loss of appetite or severe fatigue. And often a person will say, this just doesn't feel like the old me. I can't explain it. I can't understand this. This feels not just quantitatively different, but qualitatively different. Some people, it's a feeling they have in their gut or in their chest cavity, just this feeling of not being the person that they were. Now, obviously, there's milder forms of depression. And the more we understand about the genetics of depression, the more we're able to realize, for instance, that family members of a person who's been severely depressed may have struggled with milder forms of depression. And that can be a real eye-opener, because that person if they didn't know about their family history, and maybe in the future, if it wasn't, say, for a blood test that we might develop to show that they've got the propensity for depression, might have just labeled this as, you know, being an Eeyore type, just being a depressive personality, more prone to sadness than the typical person, that they just need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and buck up.
So, Dr. Bruce Cohen, is there still a fair amount of controversy over the appropriate way to treat depression?
You know, it's interesting. Even if we say that there's biological factors that play a role in depression, that in itself does not dictate that the treatment has to be biological. You can say that someone has the disorder of depression, and that's not to say that it won't respond to better exercise or to getting more light if they've got the winter blues, or to talk therapy. When you think about it, all of those experiences also have an impact on the brain and on brain chemistry. So if there is some controversy, I would say it has to do with a concern about someone going into the doctor and after a relatively brief interview being labeled as having this thing, this depression, that the answer comes in a pill bottle, and that people feel that maybe they haven't been fully appreciated or empathized with, and that the role that depression is playing in their overall life story is not being appreciated. It's just being sort of labeled as a garden variety depression, just like all the other people I've seen with depression. And here, just take this pill, you'll feel better. And so I think people have reacted against that to some extent. And psychiatrists, as well as family doctors, I think feel a certain pressure to adequately treat people with limited time at times, and especially, for instance, under managed care, having more limited resources in terms of talk therapy. But that's not to say that those other treatments aren't useful. I think everyone would agree that in the most severe forms of mental illness, for instance, a person who's grossly psychotic, that biological therapies need to play an important role in the treatment.
Sole author of the medical school textbook Theory and Practice of Psychiatry, Dr. Bruce Cohen, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Our call-in number, 888-WMRA-TALK. Claire in Batesville, thanks for using that number. Your question or comment for Dr. Cohen, please.
Thank you. Well, my question is, I'm not aware of the term obsessionality. I do know the term obsession. Obsessionality sounds like a Bushism to me. And I think that in the psycholinguistics, psychotherapy world, we need to simplify things, and we certainly don't need to make things more complicated. Perhaps there is a word, obsessionality, and I'm unaware of it, but I think the word obsession is just as true and just as good. And my second thought is, having known a forensic psychologist, a lot of it is about the money. A lot of it is about divorce. A lot of it is about accidents and being paid in order to represent a person by whom you are paid in court. And I don't know what Dr. Cohen's experience is about that, but I would love to hear that, and I'll take my answer off the air, and I appreciate it. It's a great program. Thank you.
Claire, thanks for calling in.
Two great questions. Okay, first one about obsessionality. This is actually a useful thing to point out. If you watch a show like Monk, what you're seeing is a person with obviously obsessive compulsive disorder. He has ideas that are intrusive and senseless and repetitive, and he recognizes that. And that's what distinguishes his obsessions from delusions. And yet, despite that, it causes intense anxiety, and his compulsions, such as counting or touching things or straightening a photo that's askew, is a response to that anxiety to try to relieve it.
So in those cases, obsessionality is actually a medical term.
It would be a medical term. It would be like an actual obsession. On the other hand, when we talk about golf is my obsession, or I'm obsessed with the person I'm dating, we're talking about something very different. We're talking about a passion. And we also see a group of people who are the Felix Unger types of the world, people who are perfectionistic, self-critical, set the bar very high for themselves and sort of beat themselves up when they don't measure up to that standard, and probably in many cases judge the rest other people by those same standards. That would be what we would call an obsessional personality. Some of those people could end up also having obsessive compulsive disorder, but most of them don't. And I'm sure many NPR listeners, I know myself counting as one, who sort of are obsessed with listening to NPR. I mean, I listen to it as a podcast. I listen to it in the car and in a box and with a fox. And that is more, I would say, more of a perfectionism and a desire to really understand the world better than true obsessive compulsive disorder. So I was hopefully putting myself in that latter group. In terms of the money, what I'd say about that is this. It depends. There are many forensic examiners who have salaried jobs at state hospitals or in prison systems or at community services boards here in Virginia. And so they're paid the same, whatever they say. Ideally, if I'm retained by one side or the other, the defense or the prosecution or in a civil case, the plaintiff or the defendant, I would reach the same opinion no matter which side hires me. You might not always hear that opinion, because if a plaintiff in a civil suit asked me my opinion and it didn't agree with what they were asking me to testify for, they'll say, thank you very much for your time. We won't be needing you anymore. So the fact that you can find an expert on either side of a case, I don't think proves in itself that experts are hired guns who will say whatever someone pays them to say. There might be some experts who have certain professional opinions about the nature of things, and people who retain them might know those opinions. But again, I don't think that's the same as a person whose opinion is for hire.
Claire, thank you again for your call. Next to Woodstock, Patricia, you're on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for psychiatrist Bruce Cohen, please.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Cohen. This is regarding a 17-and-a-half-year-old teenage boy who has tried to commit suicide three times. He's now in a wilderness camp at a state far from his home. His parents are divorced. He had a back injury playing hockey. He's been jilted by two girlfriends, I understand. So my question is, what is this camp going to do for him? I think he just needs two loving parents.
Oh, boy, you know, it's tricky to fully comment on that without knowing the full details, because one would imagine in many cases before a person is sent to a camp like that, there have been at least a stab at home interventions. One question that when one is clinically evaluating a case like this, you're trying to figure out is, you know, is this a kid who is just going through a difficult developmental time? Or is there something in addition going on, such as a learning disorder or an attention deficit disorder or some sort of depression? All of those things can cause a person's grades to go down or can cause a person to become more sullen or oppositional. And many of these kids do ultimately end up in the judicial system. But the courts are faced with, I've talked to juvenile justices who say, I probably see more cases of bipolar disorder than you do because so many of the kids who come in now have received mental diagnoses. So I would say in a case like this, the first step, if it hasn't been done, is for a person to receive a comprehensive clinical assessment.
But what does the camp do? Do you know what they do at wilderness camps?
Well, sometimes I think what they're trying to do is remove a person from the circumstances that might be contributing, such as if a person's involved with a gang or if a person's assaulting people in the school setting, if it's a situation with greater security. But the other might be to provide corrective experiences similar to the benefits that some people might get, say, from a military boot camp.
Patricia, I'm afraid that's all we have time for now, but thank you for your call and for getting us thinking. We're going to continue with Dr. Bruce Cohen in just a bit more than 1 minute. Forensic psychiatrists are called upon to determine everything from whether a murder suspect is competent to stand trial to whether grandma was mentally competent at the time she drew up her will. So I'm curious, do you have suggestions for other ways that you think forensic psychiatry might be put to use that we haven't even touched on yet? Or other questions for our guest about any aspect of psychiatry, since he's written a medical textbook covering the whole field? We've got an open phone line for you at 888-WMRA Talk. Our guest, Dr. Bruce Cohen, next to Harrisonburg. Sam, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Hi. I've been sober for a number of years, and I go to a program that that I'm sure you can figure out. When you were talking about labels, I just wanted to say that whether you call that the notion of disease is very helpful in helping alcoholics to get sober.
I think you're absolutely right. Although it does, when you think about it, it shows how the word disease is a loaded concept. So that, for instance, in Alcoholics Anonymous, people need to acknowledge that they've got a disease that's outside of their control. But the next step is that they need to take control of their life. They need to take responsibility, make amends with people, attend meetings frequently enough, get a sponsor if that's suggested. Now, that's true for other diseases. We tell the diabetic you need to take your insulin or you need to lose weight. But it does show that we have an ambivalence about alcoholism, that on the one hand we say it's a disease, but on the other hand, if a person is arrested for drunk driving or let's say hitting a person and killing them while they were intoxicated, the court will not say that this is eligible for an insanity defense.
Tell me about psychic pain. What is psychic pain? And is it possible that in conditions like alcoholism or other addictions or other behaviors that are considered socially unacceptable, people are experiencing something that the rest of us really just don't understand?
Well, I think this really shows how behavior is powerfully influenced by a multitude of factors. There's genetics, there's upbringing, but there's also just conditioned responses, for example, so that a person who always smokes a cigarette in the morning when they're reading the morning newspaper and they're trying to quit cigarettes, the minute they open up the morning newspaper, they feel a powerful craving to smoke a cigarette. That's not a choice to feel that craving. Right.
See, that's where I have trouble, where I suspect other people have trouble. Dr. Cohen, if you're talking about a powerful craving, all of us have experienced powerful cravings at times that we've been able to resist or wait out until it goes away. But it also seems to me that based on things I've read in your book and that I've heard you say already, that there are some people who have an experience of such intensity that the craving is so powerful that the pain that they know that they will end if they give in to the craving is so intense that the rest of us really can't empathize?
Well, I think that's one reason I think that in psychotherapy it can be hard. That one treatment for obsessive compulsive disorder, which we were talking about earlier, probably the most effective treatment we have other than medication, is called exposure and response prevention. So a person who's very concerned about germs, you might have them say, touch a toilet seat, and then tell the person you cannot wash your hands or you can't wash your hands for 10 minutes. The person will feel very intense discomfort, but like going to the gym and building up a muscle, the goal is to do this exercise over and over again so that eventually the person gains greater control over that feeling of anxiety. Now, if you did that in the absence of having a coach or a therapist doing it with you, I would say the average person just would have a lot of difficulty putting themselves through this kind of therapy. And similarly, there's people who have a lot of trouble getting control of alcohol cravings if they didn't come into the hospital to a controlled setting to be detoxed, or if they weren't going to meetings where they could be surrounded by other people who were going through the same struggle. And so there are medications that can help decrease some of this psychic pain, but usually they're not sufficient in themselves. So the best medications that we've got for alcoholism can improve the odds of achieving abstinence, but generally it's when a person's also going to a treatment program as
well. So in response to what I think the essence of Sam's question was, is it helpful to call alcoholism an illness? It sounds like you might be saying, well, under certain circumstances it is, because if we identify it as an illness, we have medications and treatments to help people. I don't know if you ever cure alcoholism.
Well,
but
plus we know that it runs
to deal with it.
By knowing that it runs in families, by knowing that your father had it and your brother had it and your grandfather had it, I think it helps people gain a greater appreciation that this is not about moral blame. On the other hand, there are elements of control in a condition like alcoholism or eating disorders such as anorexia or bulimia, particularly earlier on in the course of the condition. And that shows that some of these conditions are complicated, especially when we go into the court and we're talking about whether a person should be held legally blameworthy for what they do, for example.
888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Got a question about psychiatry or mental health we haven't addressed yet? 888-967-2825. Sole author of the medical school textbook Theory and Practice of Psychiatry, Dr. Bruce Cohen, is our guest. Next to Bill in Shenandoah County. Bill, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight.
Well, thank you so much for taking my call. I appreciate your recent discussion of the psychology of addiction. I'm 60 years old. I'd like to, and I was diagnosed at 17 as a schizophrenic. I really appreciate your doctor's point about what he spoke about a kid going into the ER because he was losing his marbles because his girlfriend broke up with him. And I just like to say, isn't there, aside from all the, you know, clinical, medical, you know, nuts and bolts diagnoses, isn't there a point where psychology has to address what we might call the dark night of the soul or a more existential question? And I'll listen to your responses offline. Thank you.
Bill, thank you.
I think that's a great question. And I think it shows that when we deal with mental life, we have a sense that we are making choices, that we're that guy behind the desk with all the telephones telling, you know, sending the rest of the messages to the body about what to do. But at the same time, what science shows us is that also there is an element of our life that's not controlled by free will, and that's determined by biology. And there's a tension there. I think a lot of the research that's going on right now in neuroscience is more and more is showing us that things that we thought were fully within our control are more predetermined by our biology than we were willing to concede. But that being said, what are you supposed to do with that when you're faced with crises in your life? Part of our goal in treating people is to look at their life story and help them create a different story or to alter the story somewhat so that the people that we see can feel less like they're in the back seat being driven around by the events of their life and more that they're in the front seat making decisions. And sometimes it doesn't take major changes in the element of that story to help a person feel more in control. And that's really the goal of therapy is to help a person understand themselves better and recognize the choices that still are available to them. So I think you're absolutely right. And I think that when people get annoyed with when they think about psychiatry, it has to do with this idea that you tell certain experiences to someone and it gets reduced to symptoms and then to a cookie cutter diagnosis.
And you talk about in your textbook how to avoid that in the practice in your field. And I take it, I got the feeling from reading as much of your text as I did, Dr. Cohen, that was part of the reason that you wrote it.
Yeah, I think that what happens is it's very easy to have a book where you talk about a list of diagnoses and these are the symptoms of that diagnosis and here's the treatments that have been most commonly used. But it doesn't really explain the thought processes. It doesn't have any kind of a conceptual scaffolding. And I think for the average, say, medical student who's training to be a doctor in general, not just a psychiatrist, they'd much prefer, I think, to just memorize the list of diagnoses. But they also, I think, would come away saying there's something soft about psychiatry. And my point is simply that I think that we can study something as ambiguous and difficult as mental life, but we can try to do it in a more rigorous and scientific way.
Next to Whitehall. Anne, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for psychiatrist Bruce Cohen, please.
Yes, hello. Thank you. I wanted to ask Dr. Cohen about what does it really mean to be mentally retarded and in terms of how fully responsible you are in negotiating your way through life, especially if your life has been difficult. So not to be cute or covert, I'm thinking of the woman recently executed in Virginia, who had an IQ of 72. And I wonder if you had any thoughts about that you'd like to talk about.
Sure. The Supreme Court has said that it's unconstitutional to execute a person who's mentally retarded or developmentally disabled. The reason that they said this is, and they had done a they had also done a decision around that same time that said that it would be unconstitutional to execute a minor. The reason they said this is not to say that people with a lower IQ are not responsible at all for their behaviors or that they're insane. It's simply to say that there's significant mitigation there, that a person's free will and choices are constrained by factors like this, so that it would be essentially unfair to do the ultimate punishment of execution for a person whose choices are somewhat more constrained because of this. But that's not to say, for instance, that a person wouldn't be given, say, life without the possibility of parole. They're just trying to draw the lines. Now, the tricky thing about developmental disability or mental retardation is when we talk about IQ, we're talking about a bell curve, with the average being 100 and with two standard deviations from the mean being 70. There's no actual bright line that's drawn at 70 to say that this person has a mental retardation condition and this person isn't. And so when you get to the margins, you could see where it creates a sense of tension and unfairness, just like a person who got a B minus compared to a C plus on an exam. There seems to be something fundamentally unfair about drawing lines there when really it's a continuous variable there. And the same could be said, for instance, when we label people as having a personality disorder. We all have personalities. Some people have a more extreme personality than others. So why would we label a person as having a personality, quote, disorder? We essentially draw that line when it's significant enough and impairing enough in a person's life that it's appropriate to diagnose it, because it helps a person understand themselves better and helps determine, helps us understand better what kind of treatments might be appropriate. And so really, it's a great question, because it really points out that some of the conditions that we talk about, such as schizophrenic, we generally don't say, oh, sometimes when I'm stressed, I'm a little schizophrenic too. We would say that is a disease and you have it or you don't. Whereas other conditions that we're looking at, such as a developmental disability, we really could say is more like what you are as opposed to what you have. I mean, I wouldn't say, do you have height, right? I would say, what is your height? And that's similar, I think, when we're talking about intelligence. It's important to know where a person falls relative to other people, because it can be a source of vulnerability depending on the circumstances they're in.
Ann, thank you so much for your call. I think we have time to fit in one more call. We're going to Lou Ray and Dick. Dick, if you could get your question or comment quickly.
Yes,
please.
Thank you. I think we need to pay attention also to drug interaction and drug reaction. Because I recently started taking a drug and looked for side effects, because all of a sudden I was starting to get depression bouts. And I finally looked through that 10,000-word package insert in teeny tiny type, and guess what? Listed way, way, way down there, one of the side effects is depression.
Dick, is it okay to ask what treatment you were seeking, what condition you were taking a drug for?
It was for energy mostly for energy.
So
libido. It was testosterone.
Okay, so it was for fatigue, among other things.
Yes.
Right? Testosterone.
Well, yeah, sure. And yes. And that kind of makes sense, doesn't it, that that we have receptors in the brain for hormones like testosterone or like estrogen or like thyroid hormone, and that it makes sense that medications might affect mood in that way. And some of the symptoms that we would label as symptoms of mental illness, like fatigue or insomnia, could clearly be due to 50 different other conditions, whether it's medical conditions or a medication that someone's on. For instance, some of the more common ones might be a beta blocker that you're taking for your blood pressure could make you very fatigued. Or it could be a medical problem, like low thyroid could make you depressed. So that's why I think, before we immediately jump to the conclusion that this symptom equals a disorder, we need to think broadly about what other things can cause that symptom. And the best way to do that, I think, is to make sure that the doctor who sees you is taking the time to really spend the time looking at other symptoms, and also that if there is a role for lab work, that they're sending those things off as well.
Dick, thank you so much for your call. In the 30 seconds we've got left, this is something that comes up again and again in your textbook. So I want to ask you to conclude talking a little bit about this, if you could, Dr. Cohen. It has to do to the degree to which some of us minimize the significance of mental illness because we really don't get what it is.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at a survey that was done about 20 years ago, I think the number one cause that people listed of mental illness was moral weakness. Being caused by biological factors of disease was about 10% of people that they surveyed. Now, that was a couple decades ago, and I would hope that things have changed some over time. When we talk about mental disorders, we're talking about conditions that can affect your thoughts, your feelings, or behaviors. The treatment doesn't necessarily have to come in a pill bottle, but I think the first step is if certain symptoms are clustering with others, it's useful to see someone who can help you see if there is some sort of a condition there.
Our guest has been Dr. Bruce Cohen, Director of Forensic Psychiatry Training at the University of Virginia, a faculty member at UVA's Institute for Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy, and author of Theory and Practice of Psychiatry. Bruce, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producer is Terry Ward and Bob Levicki. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Juspe and Inner Rhythm. Now, you can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org and then clicking on Programs and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And if you go to that page, you'll find links to more information about the work Dr. Cohen is doing. And if you go to the Virginia Insight Facebook page and click like, you'll get access to a whole bunch more information about these broadcasts there as well. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.